How do you guys like picture like the Valar?
I think they look like crabs.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. This is the first of our planned Silmarillion podcast series. We will be discussing basic history of the Silmarillion, the publication today, and the first two chapters of the book proper, as well as a letter that Tolkien wrote that's included at the beginning of the second edition. My name is Greg. I'm Claudius the Fool on the forums, and I'm joined by four other vassals today. If you guys want to just introduce yourself, let's just go in straight first name alphabetical order to keep it simple. So, Alex?
Hi, everyone. This is Alex. My forum name is Iwindiel.
This is Brett. I'm White Raven on the forums.
Matt Varley on the forums.
Hey, this is Shane, East Texas Direwolf on the forums.
Okay, so I'm glad everybody could join us today. We've got some of the same crew from the Lord of the Rings cast. I know Brett and Shane were involved in that. Alex, were you on any of those episodes or no?
Nope.
No, okay, and neither was I. So we got some carryover, but it's a new Silmarillion crew. And if you're interested, of course, please join us next recording. So I just figured if you want to go around, just say how you got into the Silmarillion. Was this your first time reading it? Had you read it before? Was this like a reread for you? And what other books by Tolkien? You know, I'm assuming everyone's read Lord of the Rings. This will have spoilers for Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion as well. I'm not going to assume anything. So, Alex, did you want to start off?
Well, I got into Tolkien through the Lord of the Rings movies, and I read the books, and then I read The Hobbit. I saw the Hobbit movies, and then I listened to the VOK podcast on Lord of the Rings. And when this call to arms started, I thought, well, I gotta read the Silmarillion now. So I read it back in March, and that was my first time reading it, so I'm rereading for the second time as we go along.
I got into the Silmarillion. I mean, I read the Lord of the Rings a long time ago, like high school, which, if you listen to the last podcast we did, it was a long time ago.
It was last year, right?
Yeah, it was like last year, last Tuesday. And I actually didn't really know anything about the Silmarillion. I got into it because I read another book that was talking about it. So I was like, oh, I didn't even know there was such a thing. So I found it in the store, picked it up, didn't make it through the first two chapters the first time, and then picked it up again later and made it all the way through it and actually liked it. So that's where I am.
Sounds good. Matt?
Let's see. So I think my parents got me like the box set of The Lord of the Rings and Hobbit, like, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago. And for like a long stretch, I'd reread that series. And then I just kind of picked up the Tolkien, and I'm sitting here with the Book of Lost Tales 1 and 2 on my desk. So, I mean, I've reread it many times. I'm kind of like a really Tolkien nerd, and just looking at some of your notes, like, I didn't know about the poem of Verendiel that he wrote in the trenches, but I found it just like hilarious how dorky he is. So I could really get behind it, and you know, I just love the books. Silmarillion's a little tough the first time I read it. I really do like the first couple chapters. The ordering of the lands of Beleriand is like unreadable.
Pulling teeth, yeah.
Oh man,
my first experience with Tolkien is I remember being aware of the animated movies when I was a kid, though I don't think I ever actually watched them. And then when I was in the Navy, our navigator was setting up some exercise areas for something we were doing, and you got to give them, you know, code names. And he was a bit of a nerd, and me and my friend were looking over them with the navigator, and different areas were called Bilbo, Gandalf, some other ones I don't remember. And I remember thinking, those are pretty strange. And the navigator came over and said, hey, you recognize the names? And he was just grinning from ear to ear, and he was so pleased with himself. And me and my friend were just giving him blank stares, like, nope. No idea what that is. It's like, hey, The Lord of the Rings, it's cool. It's like, okay. Anyway, so several years later, you know, the movies were coming out. I heard about them. So I went and got the book and said, hey, I think I'll read that for those movies come out. And read the book, loved them. I watched the movies, enjoyed them. I tried to read the Silmarillion a couple of times, and I still haven't done it. This is,
this is
my reason I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to read as we go along. I'm ready to go.
Sounds good. Yeah, I was probably like 8th or 9th grade. I was in a bookstore one day, and I saw the big one volume of Lord of the Rings, and I was like, I am never going to read this book. And I just flipped to the last page, and I read the last line of the book, and it was, you know, well, I'm back. Sam says, like, oh, what a stupid ending. And then a couple of years later, when the movies came out, I saw the first two movies totally fell in love with him, and I'd never read the books. That's when I went back and I read the first three books, and I always have a soft spot in my heart for the Return of the King, because that's the only book that I'd read before the movie, so I got to have the characters in my head first. But I tried to read the Silmarillion right after that, and I didn't know what was going on, so I put it down, and then I think it was in like my senior year of college, I reread it. And I had notes next to me, and I literally like drew the map of Valinor as I was reading it, because there's no map of Valinor. And anytime there was something physically referenced, I wrote it down and I tried to fit it in. And that's how it kind of came together in my head, was as I was trying to like make a map of it. But I've read the unfinished tales, and I've read the first Book of Lost Tales, which I know was the first of the whole histories of Middle Earth, but I haven't read the rest of those because I was originally really not interested in how the world evolved in Tolkien's head. I just wanted to take it as a finished, like, this is the history, and this happened, and then this happened. But now, after reading this, I am really interested in how it all came together. Yeah, so that's, I've read the Silmarillion twice, and this, I'm going to reread this as we go through it as well. The sections we're dealing with today are a little fresher in my mind than the rest of the book.
I do have Unfinished Tales, and I've kind of like the Silmarillion. From time to time, I'll pick it up and flip through it and just read stuff, mostly like about stuff from the Lord of the Rings, like the Ishtar. Mm-hmm. Which is the wizards, things like that, and the timelines that are in those books about the events from the Lord of the Rings. So I flipped through them a little bit, but I haven't read much about the First Age or the Second Age.
Yeah, I used to confuse, because I read Silmarillion and Unfinished Tales back to back, so they kind of blended together. And as I was looking through the table of contents, I was like, where's all this stuff about that crazy sailor from Numenor, Eldarion, I think his name was? And I realized that was from Unfinished Tales, but that's one of my favorite just stories of Tolkien's. It's only like six pages, but it's like one of the few stuff we actually get that's set on Numenor, and it's like a fairy tale almost. But maybe we'll get to that after the 12 podcasts for the Silmarillion.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wish Tolkien had actually just set, even though he didn't have like a contract to write it, I wish he'd just done it anyway, so it wasn't just like Christopher Tolkien editing it and putting it together.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about just the way it came together, because there's, even in its finished form, there's a battle between people who believe it's more Christopher than Tolkien himself. Basically, these were the stories that he had these stories written down before he even came up with Hobbits or anything in Lord of the Rings. The first part of it that Tolkien ever came up with was actually a poem that he just wrote down one day in 1914, which was based off of he was a professor of Anglo-Saxon, and he was a philologist, and all his stuff basically came from his love of language. And this name Eärendil was in this poem by a 9th century Anglo-Saxon poet named Cynewulf, or Cynewulf if it's the Tolkien pronunciation. But it's a short poem. I'll read it here because it's a beautiful poem, and it makes no sense whatsoever, but it in retrospect as to what became the Silmarillion, it makes a lot of sense. But if someone just picked this and read it, I can see how they would have been like, what are you writing about here, JR? Here's the poem. It's from 1914. He wrote on one day when he was on vacation. Eärendil sprang up from the ocean's cup, in the gloom of the mid-world's rim, from the door of night as a ray of light leapt over the twilight brim, and launching his bark like a silver spark from the golden fading sand, down the sunlit breath of day's fiery death, he sped from Westerland.
Good shit.
Yeah, it's a good poem that you could definitely write. Some of the, he took bits and pieces from this poem. Mid-world actually was the inspiration for Middle-earth, and basically, throughout World War I, he was a soldier. He was an officer in the war. He basically was sick during a lot of the fighting. He was only in a few battles, but he was recovering from trench foot in 1915. And that's when he started to actually, write down stories. He wrote a couple poems. He called them My Nonsense Fairy Language, and these stories that he just wrote for himself. And they were eventually became the histories of the Elder Days, which is the first age of Middle-earth. And he began with the Eärendil, worked his way back. Eventually, it all kind of came clear in his mind. There's a quote from Tolkien's biography by Humphrey Carpenter where he says, "This was the language spoken by fairies and elves whom Eärendil saw during his strange voyage." So basically, he started with the Eärendil, and he kind of just wanted to build and, build sort of like a rubber band ball. Everything kind of focused around that, and it became bigger and bigger. He wrote poems about the creation of the sun and moon, the tales of Eldamar, Two Trees, and Valinor itself. But those were all poems. Short, some were shorter, some were longer than others. And the first actually short story that he wrote was The Fall of Gondolin in 1916, which takes place towards the end of the First Age in Middle-earth, but that was the first actual concrete tale that he wrote down from the Silmarillion. He also began writing the Book of Lost Tales, which was never published during his lifetime, in 1917, while recovering from, trench fever, not trench foot. Big difference there. I don't know if you go to hospital for trench foot, but you do for trench fever. So he thought he completed his version of the Book of Lost Tales in 1923. The story is told from the point of view of a sailor named Ariel, or Elfwing, of England, who washes up on the shores of Tol Eressëa, which is basically the land off the coast of Valinor. and he's, you know, finds his way into this house of this elf, and he's told all these tales, and that's how we learn the tales along with this lost mariner. He also writes them as long poems. He's like epic poems. He did the Tale of Turin and the Lay of Lathian, which became the Tale of Beren and Lúthien. Throughout the 1930s, he was always writing the Silmarillion, but he also was writing the Hobbit at this time. And he never really officially tried to get it published. He was writing them for himself and for his own, for his family. He used to tell these stories to his children as well.
They were separate in his head when he was writing The Hobbit, right? Well, I mean, The Hobbit didn't connect it into the world, the elves and all that.
Yeah, the way The Hobbit originally was published, it's tough to find an actual first, not just a first edition is tough to find anyway, but he actually reworked it once it was re-released in the 50s, I believe, to make it fit better together with the Lord of the Rings and the world as a whole.
So he did a George Lucas before George Lucas.
The Hobbit was a massive success. It came out in 1937. It was a bestseller in England and in the U.S. as well. And his publisher, Allen and Unwin, really wanted Tolkien to write a sequel to The Hobbit. They wanted more Hobbits. They wanted another book that could be on the bestseller charts. And he gave them a manuscript of The Silmarillion, and he wanted this published. And he got this sort of interesting rejection letter, a very nice rejection letter from his publisher, Stanley Unwin, from December 15th, 1937. And it says, "The Silmarillion contains plenty of wonderful material. In fact, it is a mine to be explored in writing further books like The Hobbit, rather than a book in itself. What we badly need is another book with which to follow up our success with The Hobbit. And alas, neither of these manuscripts quite fits the bill. I still hope that you will be inspired to write another book about The Hobbit." So this is basically his publisher saying, that's great, but give us another Hobbit. Which, you know... That kind of happened with Suzanne Collins in The Hunger Games a couple years ago. She didn't plan to write a trilogy, but her publishers wanted more Katniss Everdeen, and she gave it to them. And some people love her for that, and some people hate her for that. The Silmarillion was something that was always in the back of his mind as he was writing his other books, and he really thought it was the main story he was telling because it was so personal to him. And we'll get into the reasons of why he was writing these stories when we talk about the letter at the beginning of The Silmarillion. 1950, he wrote to his publishers, Allen and Unwin, that he wanted them to publish The Lord of the Rings with The Silmarillion. He said if they didn't publish it, he was basically going to leave them to go to another publishing house. He's very polite. If you read his letters, he's very testy, and he goes back and forth between an editor at Collins and at Stanley Unwin, and he basically is promised that if he goes to Collins, they'll publish the Silmarillion, but then that falls through, and he's forced to go back to, you know, sort of back to Allen and Unwin with his tail between his legs, but it all worked out in the end. Martin Waldman actually was his friend at Collins who he wrote the letter to at the beginning of the Silmarillion, and he vehemently did not want Lord of the Rings divided into three books. He considered it one book, and the only allowance he would make was that there could be a division between The Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings. So in 1952 to 54, there was a sort of unofficial publishing battle between Allen and Unwin and Collins because Tolkien considered his obligation to Allen and Unwin fulfilled with The Hobbit, but he felt like he owed them because they took a chance on him by publishing The Hobbit when it was a kind of book that no one really thought was interested in, and he basically made them a ton of money. And he felt a moral obligation, not a legal obligation, to stick with Allen and Unwin. Throughout all this back and forth, they ended up publishing Fellowship of the Ring in 1954, and then Two Towers and Return of the King followed pretty quickly in 1955. So throughout the 60s and early 70s, Tolkien retires from Merton College at Oxford, where he was a professor for over 40 years. I mean, he planned to finish The Silmarillion, but he was, you know, constantly called away from other projects, familial obligations, and he decided that in the end, he scrapped the entire manuscript and tried to rework it because he wanted it to ensure that the Silmarillion harmonized with The Lord of the Rings in every detail. And he passed away in 1973. He had stomach issues, and he thought he was just going in for a routine operation, and he died very quickly after that, and he was 81 years old. But before he passed away, he had this agreement with his son that Christopher, who was his third and youngest son, would sort of carry on to be his literary executor and to try to get the Silmarillion published. He and Christopher often discussed the book, and they knew that there were a ton of problems that remained to be solved, but they didn't really make any progress. There's a quote here from his biography that just shows that even though Christopher was his youngest son, he seemed to be the kid that sort of was the most open to Tolkien's stories, because he would just tell these stories as, you know, fairy tales to his kids. And it's from Humphrey Carpenter's biography of Tolkien. "Within the family, the most frequent listener to the stories was Tolkien's third son, Christopher. The boy," wrote Tolkien in his diary, "had grown up into a nervy, irritable, cross-grained, self-tormenting, cheeky person. Yet there is something intensely lovable about him, to me at any rate, from the very similarity between us. On many evenings in the early 1930s, Christopher, huddled for warmth by the study stove, would listen motionless while his father told him about the elvish wars against the Black Power, and how Beren and Lúthien made their perilous journey to the very heart of Morgoth's iron stronghold. These were not mere stories. They were legends that came alive as his father spoke, vivid accounts of a grim world where foul orcs and a sinister necromancer guarded the way, and a dreadful red-eyed wolf tore the elvish companions of Beren to pieces one by one. But a world also where three great elvish jewels, the Silmarillii, shone with a strange and powerful light. In a world against all odds, the quest could be victorious. So Christopher, he made an effort, but he ended up bringing in Guy Gavriel Kay, who's later became a very popular fantasy author. He was a student at the time, and he basically put out the word that he needed an assistant to go through Tolkien's papers, and he was the guy that really helped him through that. And through the years, because Kay was a friend of Christopher Tolkien's wife, so he never really spoke about the process because it kind of blurred the lines between professionalism and his personal stories. But there was a really interesting interview with him from First's Magazine from October 2012, which is a book collecting magazine, where he says, "The Silmarillion was published in 1977 to cheers, and some jeers from critics and Tolkien fans. Some felt Christopher Tolkien and company had successfully pulled off the nearly impossible task of putting together a book from the fragmentary materials that Tolkien left behind. Others complained that too much guesswork in the process had marred the results. Many readers who had expected another Hobbit or Lord of the Rings were put off by the results." And that was actually the editor of the magazine.
I could see that. I see why people were upset with it. But on the other hand, I'm glad it exists.
Absolutely.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It seems like, from what I've read, Christopher Tolkien is always upfront about what's clear and what's his father's and what he is inferring, which, is good, and it seems better this than nothing.
Oh, absolutely. I'm like you said, Brett, I'm definitely happy we have it, and I never thought that he was making a lot of stuff up. I mean, he's talked about how when he went back to the stuff from the 20s and 30s, a lot of it was written in pencil that was barely legible, but since he had been told these stories as a child, I mean, there's no better person to do this than Christopher.
Definitely.
Yeah, and you could definitely see like how he could have made the transitions between chapters a lot smoother. Like, Silmarillion at, very worst of times is extremely just kind of clunky and repetitive, and it's like, this chapter is just like the last one, what happened? So I think, it shows that they're taking just manuscripts and just kind of plopping them in where they thought they went.
I think it's Melkor's influence. Clunky, exactly. And repetitive, that's what he does.
Chaos. He thrives in chaos.
It was in the music, we can't help it.
So before we get to the actual Silmarillion proper, when it first came out, it was just the straight text. It was just a basic introduction that explained the process. But in the second edition, which came out in 1999, I believe, Christopher Tolkien included a letter that his father had written to Martin Waldman, who was the publisher who was contemplating taking on publishing the Silmarillion back in 1950. I just made a couple bullet points here. It's a 20-page letter, and he can definitely write a letter. But figure we can just talk about some of the main points that he brought up.
I just like the insights it gave to what he was thinking in some places.
I think it's interesting he calls it the Christian mythology when he was a Christian, but he's calling it a mythology anyway.
He was he was a devout Catholic, which he tried not to put in his books. I mean, he talks in the letter about allegory and how he dislikes allegory, but he's best friends with C.S. Lewis, who was very overt in putting his Christian overtones into the Chronicles of Narnia, and Tolkien specifically didn't do that. Subcreation was the most honorable thing that a creative you could do creatively, because it doesn't take away from God and it doesn't go against anything that's in the Christian mythos, if that makes sense.
As long as you don't love too much the work of your own hands.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah, his main thought, why he wanted to write this was that he always felt that England lacked its own mythology. It had been, conquered by so many different peoples and invaded that it didn't really have a mythology of its own. And, it had Arthur and everything, but then some people say Arthur was actually French. And, and he wanted to give England a mythology. And there was a quote from the letter where he says, "I had a mind to make a body of more or less connected legend, ranging from the large and cosmogenic to the level of romantic fairy story, the larger founded on the lesser in contact with the earth, the lesser drawing splendor from the vast backcloths, which I could dedicate simply to England, to my country. The cycles should be linked to a majestic whole, and yet leave scope for other minds and hands, wielding paint and music and drama. Absurd." So, at several points in this letter, he actually poked fun at himself, where he knows it's a almost silly thing that he's doing, but he takes a strange amount of pride in it, and I can respect him for that.
I love the idea, though. I kind of almost wish he'd followed through and done it. It would have been very interesting, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if when he says for other hands to take up and other minds and hands wielding paint and music. Do you think that he wanted other people to write stories in his universe, like fan fiction almost, or he's talking about something different there?
Well, he gave his son the green light, I suppose.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like he's, you know, definitely encouraging others, or he hopes that others will explore, you know, the world he created.
Without shipping.
Yeah. The Tolkien professor on his podcast, I think it was one about The Hobbit, but he was talking about how Tolkien was such the old English traditions of writing from the Middle Ages and stories, and what they did a lot of was retelling stories like the Arthurian legend, how it's been told over and over again, and that was sort of considered high art to look at it from a different way and, you know, present something new with it. So it seems that that's something that Tolkien would definitely, you know, not be offended by.
Yeah, he did say at some point that he believed there were no good book had been written after the 14th century. So, you know, he had definitely like early Middle English sensibilities. But yeah, I haven't read much pre-14th century literature myself.
Yeah, I think just Beowulf, right? Wasn't that like 12th or 13th century?
Yeah, I think that's even, might have been even earlier, like 9th or 10th.
Which I think he translated for his thesis, right?
Yeah, that was actually one of his earliest published works, and it was just recently reissued by Houghton Mifflin this year with like a new introduction by Christopher Tolkien. And, you know, I just picture Christopher Tolkien like going through his cartons of Tolkien stuff, like, here's a paper with 6 words on it, let's get that into a book, because after they published...
Call Peter Jackson.
Oh, no, he hates Peter Jackson. Don't mention Peter Jackson to him.
Christopher Tolkien does?
Yeah, he hates what he did with Lord of the Rings. He thinks he turned it into an action movie for 15-year-old boys, and he didn't. That's why he won't let him touch the Silmarillion, because they want to let it lie.
The boatloads of money must have helped.
Yeah, that's true.
Really? See, that's interesting, because I assumed, you know, in another 7 or 8 years we'd be getting the Silmarillion trilogy.
Well, I know he released The Children in Ahern and the expanded version, and there's supposed to be the Beren and Lúthien tale and The Fall of Gondolin. Mm-hmm. All are supposed to come out in separate books that are longer narratives, obviously, than the stories here.
Right, but
so who knows?
I hope so, but also Christopher Tolkien edited a partially completed tale of King Arthur that came out a couple years ago, The Fall of Arthur, and in that introduction he said, this will be my last, or second to last, Tolkien, you know, I'm not going to publish anymore. He's 86, 87 years old.
Can't
himself.
Live forever.
And so I would think that if he had those lying around that they would have been out by now. And I know the tale of Beren Lúthien, I believe, was told in epic poem form, and I don't know if that would have been 10 or 15, maybe 20 pages, but... I still want to read it, but I'm assuming that there's still plenty to come out, even if it's going to be Christopher's son or daughter that publishes it.
Oh, and how cool is it that J.R.R. Tolkien and his wife, on their tombstones, it's Beren and Lúthien?
It's very sweet.
You know, it's adorable.
It is, and I picture him as this just like old professor smoking his pipe, but he has this fairy tale with his wife where he met her when he was like 16 or 17, and he fell madly in love with her, but she was the ward of this like evil priest, and the priest wouldn't let them meet in private, and he wouldn't even let them like hang out together. And basically the day that she turned 21 years old, they went and got married, and like once she was out from under him, and they were together for 60 years or something like that. And he always called her my Lúthien, and like you said, it's on their tombstones, Beren and Lúthien. It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I imagine him just as like literally a human that is a hobbit, or something like that.
He did like his little vests or his waistcoats and all that. Yeah, so in the letter he speaks a lot about giving England mythology, and the other thing he talks about allegory, how, you know, he says, I dislike allegory, the conscious and intentional. Conscious and intentional allegory, yet any attempt to explain the purpose of myth or fairy tale must use allegorical language. It would be tough not to, and it's very easy to say this means this and this means this. You know, people always say that, you know, Saruman was Hitler, and there's all these World War II allegory in Lord of the Rings. But I take him at his word where he says he wasn't doing that intentionally. But it's, like you said, it's tough to retell these tales that have been told many times, you know, throughout going back to antiquity.
Nothing new under the sun.
Right. Everything that's going to be told has already been told.
Right, and then that's where he puts it on the reader as it's not my allegory, it's their applicability. Mm-hmm. whatever they're bringing in and saying, oh, well, this obviously, you know, reads like this. This obviously is that.
He also talks about the use of magic, and this is one of the reasons that I fell in love with Tolkien, because I was always a science fiction reader, and I never really read fantasy, and I couldn't take magic seriously. Like, if there's someone waving a wand, and I'm one of the few people that couldn't get into the Harry Potter books. I mean, I read the first two. I found them enjoyable, but I stopped halfway through the third one. And just because it seemed too simple for me, it just seemed like you just say a spell and this happens. And you can count the times in Lord of the Rings that magic is used on one hand. And in the Silmarillion, it's, you know, you have gods and you have these angel-like beings, but he does keep the actual use of magic to a minimum. You know, it's battles, there's swords, it's pretty straightforward, you know, the way things gets done. I mean, yes, you have talking dogs at one point, and it does get a...
Only three times.
Exactly, and there's rules. And when there is magic, there's rules.
Yeah, I like the way he describes it as art and craft, but, like, it's such a sophisticated level that, you know, to the untrained eye, it would appear to be magic.
Right, that, like, when I think he's talking about the elves there, it's almost like the Arthur C. Clarke, you know, that any sufficiently advanced civilization's technology would seem magical to a lesser civilization. I'm sure I just butchered that, and that's not the... whatever.
We have flying machines. They probably seem like magic.
Exactly.
To a guy riding a horse.
Yeah, Rendil was just in a plane.
He was in a boat. It flew. Come on.
And another thing that he brought up in the letter that comes out throughout the Silmarillion is the whole idea of the doom of men, that the fact that they die, that's not a bad thing. It's a gift. It's a mystery. And the elves are almost jealous of the men, that they go somewhere else when they die. And I sort of, this is the as close as Tolkien gets to being overtly Christian, because the idea of heaven might be the halls of Mandos and everything, but he leaves it open for this other thing to happen, the great unknown. And that's something that I always kind of found haunting. And he calls it a gift several times. And, you know, the fact that men have freedom from the circles of the world. And I just found that's something that's always stuck with me from the Silmarillion.
Yeah, I always found it, like, you know, it depends on what side you look at it. Men call it the doom of men, and, you know, Iluvatar said it was his gift to men. So I guess it depends on what side of the coin you're on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're 73, you're like, screw this.
Yeah, and I guess some of the elves got tired of living forever as well.
Yeah, that. Well, I like the fact that before we read anything about Valinor, like, we hear of it referenced a couple times in Lord of the Rings, and you think it's heaven, basically, but when you read about it, it's not heaven, because some shit went down, and some pretty, you know, giant black spiders and crap, that it's not just heaven, and it's, because if it was just heaven, I mean, I think I'd be bored, but there's other stuff going on, so I'm thankful for that.
Man, this bliss is such a drag.
Oh, such, yeah. Heavenly ennui and all that.
I wish something would just happen. Let's have a party.
Okay, so there's Valinor. That's where the elves go, right?
No, it depends.
Well, there's two. The way I'm reading it, it looked like there's two islands, like one for the elves, and then there's one even the elves can't go to.
The elves have Tol Eressëa.
Right. Okay. Except for the Vanyar, who stayed.
Yes.
Right.
Okay, so where did Frodo and Bilbo get to go?
They went to Tol Eressëa.
Yeah.
They would still get to go to Valinor and hang out with the Valar at some point. They just don't live there, right?
No, they would die too quick. They can't go to Valinor.
Really? I didn't know. I'm showing my ignorance here. But
oh, it's all right. It's too much bliss. You just pass away, which Bilbo would probably be cool with. So would Frodo. I guess they wanted to pass away.
So the elves can let anybody come to their island that they want, but no one can go to the God Island.
No, but mortal men can't even go to Eressëa, I believe.
They can't sail west.
Yeah.
Hobbits can't?
Well, there was like a special Hobbit, Bilbo and Frodo got like a special loophole. Like, hey, you guys can come because you were ring bearers.
And so did Gimli for some reason.
Because him and Legolas were bros.
Oh, Galadriel put in a good word for him.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So the rules can be bent for the special elf island, but the special god island, that's no bending rules for that.
Well, you actually, if that's true, I've read this three times, and I never picked up on the fact that the elves, they can't go to Valinor, they just have to hang out in Tol Eressëa forever and gaze longingly at it, because that seems kind of cruel, because I hope they get to Valinor.
I think they can go there, they just don't live there.
Okay, so there we go. So yeah, Frodo gets to go to Valinor and hang out with
Manwë. And die blissfully.
Okay. Yeah.
But I just want to talk, there's a couple like really good interpretations and artwork that goes with the Silmarillion. There's a hardcover edition that has the illustrations by Ted Naismith, who's a really amazing painter. He's done some Song of Ice and Fire stuff also. But the 2009 Tolkien calendar had all his paintings from the Silmarillion, and there's some really beautiful paintings there. And there's also the Atlases of Middle-earth by Karen Wynne Fonstad, which has these really technical and super cheesy, like, pictures of, like, the House of Tulkas and the Gardens of Lorien, which is a little house. But there, it's good because it shows it on a map, and, like, you can actually see, like, the western end of Valinor, which is, like, you know, the westernmost lands where all the dead people hang out.
Okay, so where do the hobbits fall in as far as the doom or gift of men?
They're like men.
Okay. Yeah, they're mortal.
Hobbits are basically men that evolved to be smaller.
But that doesn't include dwarves.
So short people kept breeding.
No, dwarves are separate. We'll get to the dwarves.
Okay.
But,
These are questions people want to know, but we'll get to them.
We will get to them. You have to come
all
back
in good time.
For episode 6.
I know
six.
When I was reading, I was like, just get to the dwarves already.
Yeah, I think the hobbits, you know, they came over out of the west, out of the east at some point and settled in the Shire. It was referenced, but they're not humans, and they're definitely not elves, but they do have pointy ears in the movies. And the last thing just to bring up from the letter was he talks about legend and myth, where he says, Tolkien says, "After all, I believe that legends and myths are largely made of truth, and indeed present aspects of it that can only be received in this mode. And long ago, certain truths and modes of this kind were discovered and must always reappear." So that kind of goes along with what I think you were saying, Shane, about repeating, you know, there's a reason that these stories exist over time, and that it's good to have them. And this truth is in the stories, even if he's talking about completely made-up characters. All right, so let's start the Silmarillion. So basically, it begins with the Ainulindale, which is the creation myth of the entire universe that that the Valar reside in. It begins with the music of the Ainar. We have Eru Ilúvatar, who is the one god, the creator of all heavens and earths, and he is the guy that has the Flame Imperishable, which is referenced several times, which is some sort of, you know, the spark of life, the soul that only he has. Basically, before the world existed, we know there were these spirits, and they each sang a song. And this, I've always sort of been confused as the interpretation of the, do you guys think the music of the Ainur is Ilúvatar sort of showing them what will happen, and this is your roles, or are they doing it on their own? Or what did you guys think of this as a creation myth? Because it's pretty different than a lot of the creation myths that we have out there, where it's just a god saying this is going to happen and then this is going to happen. It seems like he delegates a lot of his or her. No, it's his. His power.
The way I see it is he pulled them. It says in here that he pulled them from his mind. So to me, they already know what they're supposed to do because they came from his mind. And then he just lets them do what they want. And they end up learning and actually have their own consciousnesses so they can become more than what he gave them. But he pulled them from his mind, so they already know what to do.
Yeah, but he did show them first before, because I was reading it. And then at one point, you know, everything creation is happening. And then I realized, because as I'm reading, nothing's happening. He's just kind of telling them what they're going to do. And then they actually go do it. Didn't that happen? Did I dream that?
Yeah, I think the song is him showing the Ainur what's going to happen and what their role is going to be. And they kind of join in by singing the same theme as him. And then after the song is finished, he's like, oh, but none of this is really, now you have to do it for real.
Yeah, because they were all like just standing around singing by themselves, and then he's like, hey, everybody together.
Yeah,
come on.
And of course,
you too, Melkor, stop playing in the corner.
Yeah. And of course, quote unquote singing, it's just as far as I take it, it's just a way to describe it that we can, so we understand, can have an idea in our mind of what it is.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it, because if you do get, with any sort of creation myth, if you do get bogged down in the details, it takes away from what it's trying to tell you.
It was creation, people. It was hard.
Didn't sound hard.
But I think this is similar to the creation myths of Nordic cultures and possibly the Irish. I feel like I read some old Irish folk tales that were like this, that it all started from music.
Well, he was very influenced by Celtic culture and by Finnish culture, which I think he did take a lot of the inspiration from the Kalevala, which was the Norse creation, you know, the whole pantheon of gods and their creation myths, which I have not read personally, but I know he did rely heavily on that.
Well, yeah, because there's Isgard and Middlegard, which is Middle Earth.
But is there any reason why it's called Middle-earth in the Tolkien's work? Because it's not really in the middle of anything that I can discern.
Well, I know just from that poem that we quoted at the beginning, that's where he takes the quote of Midworld from that 9th century poem. I think he probably, he was a word geek. He was all about how words sounded. You know, he would create these words and then build a story based off the name. And so I think he just liked the way it sounded and said, hey, I like that. I'm going to go with that. And he did change it to Middle Earth, but it's interesting that if Stephen King years later, when he wrote his epic Dark Tower series, he called his world was Midworld. And that was, it literally was this world that was a world that you opened a door to get to. It was this parallel far future, you know, universe. So we've got to put a spoiler warning for the Dark Tower now. So.
Yeah, but like, you know, the Nordic myths and everything, Earth is literally, you know, in the middle. Creation is a giant tree, and you've got, you know, the underworlds with the roots underneath and the heavens with up in the branches. So it kind of makes sense there. But as far as, you know, Tolkien's, it doesn't really. But yeah. I mean, it sounds cool.
I think we can give him a break on that because all his other words are so great. Yeah. I love the names. Like, Ina Lindele, it's such a pretty name. It's one of my favorite names in the book. And it means, like, music of the Ainu. And just the name sounds musical, like Ina Lindele. Sounds like something you could sing.
Yeah. Well, he does that a lot where you will hear a name in a made-up language, but somehow it resonates with you, and you kind of know what it means, even though you don't know what it means. And
but, like, to me, Iluvatar sounds like love and light together. And I guess if I wanted a god and picked it out, that's probably what I'd want him to stand on.
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of the music, you know, you get this, each god, each Ainur is sort of weaving their own themes within it, which, if they all know what's going to happen anyway, seems, you know, that's why I was always confused as to if they all know what's going to happen, you know, if they basically were told that everything up to the end of the Third Age, they know kind of what's going to happen, then why does Melkor rebel and why does he do what he does? Is it because he was, you know, rebuffed by Varda, or was it, he's not going to go along with it no matter what? But if he knew in the end that he would fail, it seems kind of silly that he would go through with it anyway.
But it does say that they don't know everything.
Right.
I mean, I think
only Mandos does, right?
He doesn't even know everything. He just knows more than the rest. Because he doesn't know when the elves are coming or when the men are coming.
Well, like, for Melkor, it's just pride, right? He knows, but he thinks he can change it.
Yeah, probably. Or he was just like, when they were telling him, he's like, I'm not watching that shit. I'm going to go look for the flame imperishable while everybody else is looking over there.
But he did not find it because it resides in Iluvatar alone. That was one of my favorite.
He did find a huge-ass spider.
You know, that's when I was reading this. I remember in The Lord of the Rings, when those podcasts, we were talking about how there were certain things that came out of the abyss that was nothing. Is that what they, like, are they outside of Iluvatar? Were they not created by him?
Everything's from his head, I think. We have Ea, we have Arda, Middle-earth, Valinor. You know, I think Ea is everything, the whole shebang, creation, and then Arda is the world that we're, you know, but it's all from Iluvatar's head, or mind at least.
Which is kind of scary because he made Melkor, so he has a bad streak in him.
Yeah.
It's realistic.
Maybe he just thought it'd be really boring if there was no...
Probably.
Was just, yeah, I guess he just created Melkor as a wild card, like, oh, I'm going to give this one lots of pride and lots of talent, and let's see if he stays good or turns evil.
I will make him the most powerful. And he just, like, ignores his outbursts in the thing, and he, like, smiles at them. He's like, yep, just the way I made him.
I wonder if... Melkor is, I guess he's got to be the most powerful because he battles all the other ones.
Well, he is.
And that's like Satan. You know, Satan was the greatest angel and he's the one that rebelled.
Well, that's what we have.
We don't want to draw direct comparisons, right? But it's interesting.
Yeah, but Melkor is basically Satan.
The Ainur are angels. You know, there's different classes of angels with the seraphim and the cherubim, and we do have, you know, the Aratar, which are the top Valar, and then you've got the lesser ones and the Maiar. But I did these little bios just of, like, any titles that the Valar have, and Melkor has the most. He's, you know, he who arises in might, dark enemy of the world. He says great might was given to him by Iluvatar. He was co-evil with Manwë, which I assumed meant he was equal, but it just means they were created at the same time. Says he had knowledge and power of all the other Valar, but always coveted power. A spirit wasteful and pitiless. Fell from splendor through arrogance to contempt for all things save himself. And that's definitely, like you mentioned, Satan with Lucifer falling from grace. That's, like you said, that's a pretty good connection there. And they say he is the most powerful.
Do you think Manwë could go against the combined might of all the other ones, including Melkor?
Well, I mean, Melkor couldn't go against, like, Tulkas. He got thrown on his face and had his feet chopped off, right?
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
Oh, Christ, sorry.
No, it's that's fine.
Well, I mean, not. I guess if he directly, you know, all right, let's put it, do it now.
But. Let's throw down.
So we can get into the just because the Music of the Ainur is basically the unfolding of all the events that will happen throughout the deeps of time, the First Age, the Second Age, and the Third Age. And they say that the music ended before the Dominion of Men, and the Dominion of Men basically came with the rise of, you know, when Aragorn took up the throne of Gondor. That's the end of the Third Age. So basically, this is the time frame that the Valar kind of know what's going on, which is kind of weird to me that it kind of goes for like the whole, you know, absent creator where he just creates it and then leaves after a certain point, because it's weird. I can't think of any other culture that has, I mean, there's like Ragnarok where you have the great battle and that's the end, but I'm trying to think of like another culture that has like up to a certain point we know what's going on and then we're kind of done with it.
Yeah, it sounded like, I thought it was really interesting, it sounded like there was a whole lot of shit going down before quote unquote recorded history, as far as the elves know it. So there was ages and ages of battles and fighting between, you know, Melkor, you know, trying to working counter to the other Valar in their, what they were trying to create.
Yeah, it's time that's not named. It's unnamed, unnumbered years, because basically everything we get is what the elves were told when they got to Valinor. So they weren't there yet, and the Valar themselves had no reckoning of time. You know, we didn't even have a sun and a moon or anything like that. So it could be a million years, it could be a billion years, it could be 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm. As far as like power levels go, though, the Valar were trying to create, whereas Melkor was just trying to destroy what they created, which takes a whole lot less than it takes to create something. So if he was just like, oh, you built a mountain? Bam, that mountain's gone. And then he ran away. I mean, it's kind of tough to fight that. I mean, he could be anywhere.
Yeah, well, that was one of my favorite, the way he ended the Ainul Indelei. I just wanted to read that last paragraph because it's one of the most beautiful passages of the book. And he does this over and over again where he just ends a chapter with this amazingly beautiful passage. And this is one of the best, where he says, this is basically Melkor versus the Valar round one, where he says, thus began the first battle of the Valar with Melkor for the dominion of Arda. And those tumults the elves know but little. The Valar endeavored ever, in spite of Melkor, to rule the earth and to prepare it for the coming of the firstborn. And they built lands, and Melkor destroyed them. Valleys they delved, and Melkor raised them up. Mountains they carved, and Melkor threw them down. Seas they hollowed, and Melkor spilled them. And naught might have peace or come to lasting growth, for as surely as the Valar began a labor, so would Melkor undo it or corrupt it. Slowly, nonetheless, the earth was fashioned and made firm, and thus was the habitation of the children of Iluvatar established at the last in the deeps of time and amidst the innumerable stars. So he's at the end of
this.
He's a dick. Yeah. But at least the earth is ready for the children, for the elves and the men to come. And I do like the fact that they're all just waiting for the elves to show up. It's like their purpose as gods is to prepare the way for their creations, which is pretty humbling a little bit. And I like that.
Yeah, it's like they're preparing the baby's room.
And they keep fighting about it. It's like, no, I don't want yellow.
No, I want pink.
I like when they describe Melkor's music in the thing. I know we already talked about it a little bit, but I'm just going to read this little thing. It's like, the music was loud and vain and endlessly repeated, and it had little harmony, but rather a clamorous unison of many trumpets braying upon few notes. So like we said before, it's just like the same thing over and over again, louder and louder and louder.
So I always thought of it. I'm assuming everyone here has seen the cartoon version of Grinch That Stole Christmas, when he's like recounting the Whoville Christmas and like they're making like just that clanking noise that like drives him insane. That's what I always pictured it as.
I thought it was interesting when Iluvatar pulls Ulmo aside after they finish listening to the music. He's like, man, why'd you let Melkor be a part of that, basically? And he showed him that, like, if it wasn't for Melkor, they wouldn't have had, like, the extreme temperatures, and they wouldn't have had rain, and they wouldn't have had snowfall. and it wouldn't have brought Elmo and Manwë together in the way that it does with like clouds and that sort of thing. And Elmo was like, oh, well, me and Manwë are going to be boys then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they use that, you know, they say that Melkor's weapons are darkness and cold, and that he used cold, but in like you said, in using it, he actually made something beautiful out of it, which, you know, of course, Eru was like, oh yeah, I knew about that. That was going to happen anyway. But I let him think it, that it was him.
Which is why I don't think his part in the music wouldn't have sounded bad. I just think it would have like been like a child trying to be louder and louder and louder, but then the music around it making it not sound that bad because of what it was. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anyone's listened to the audiobook version of this, but there's a really amazing audio version. It's read by Martin Shaw, but they do this thing at the beginning and end of each chapter. There's this very slow build up with this epic like timpani drums, and then at the end of each chapter it comes together, and it's like 45 seconds, and it just, I was actually going to throw that at the beginning of the podcast just to get people in the mood, but it's haunting, and it's this really just rousing epic music, and it's just an amazing audiobook anyway, if you get the unabridged recording read by Martin Shaw, as he says at the end of each chapter.
Oh, maybe I have a different version, because they do the same thing, but the guy's voice is like really harsh, and it's like, and then Elevata, like,
well, he does the
just like really, really like.
Why? Well, it's funny. I knew you read it because you say Iluvatar, because that's how he says it in the audiobook, and he puts the accent on the wrong. It's Iluvatar. That's how you should say it. And they even talk about that in the Tolkien Professor. They spend like 20 minutes talking about how to pronounce Iluvatar. And it's Iluvatar. So I don't know, like, who in his editing booth was like, yeah, just throw the accent anywhere you want. Iluvatar. It just took me out of it. But it's an amazing recording otherwise. All right. So we've got the Valar. All these creatures, they're all Ainur. Ainur is, I believe, encompasses all of them. They're all these beings. The Valar are the higher ones. There's the Aratar, who are like the eight most, or two, three, four, five, sorry, 12 most, the top Valar. And then you have the Maiar, which are the lesser beings. The lords of the Valar are Manwë, who is the, you know, High King of Valinor. Ulmo, who's the Lord of Waters, this Poseidon-like figure. Aule, who is the creator. Orome, this, you know, strong hunter of sorts. Mandos is the keeper of the dead. Lorien is the Sandman, basically, master of visions and dreams. And you have Tulkas, who is this like everlast, you know, greatest in strength and deeds of prowess, the valiant. So this real, you know, go-getter.
he was the Hercules.
Can I read his thing?
Oh, please do.
He delights in wrestling and contests of strength, and rides no steed, for he can outrun all things that go on foot. And he is tireless. His hair and beard are golden, and his flesh ruddy. His weapons are his hands. He has little need for the past or the future, and he is of no avail as a counselor.
But he's a hearty friend.
I know. I love how he's just like laughing and throwing people around.
And I think he's got the cool. Some of the Valar have surnames, and Astaldo, it doesn't seem to fit, because a lot of his, I don't know, it just sounds Tulkas Astaldo. Like, I figure as this like water polo player for some reason. This is just like upper class dude who's just laughing on it, even though he doesn't ride a horse. I know, but I like his surname. So, and also the Valier, if we're French, are the queens of the Valar. I guess, Alex, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Perfectly.
We have Varda. She is the Lady of the Stars. In light is her power and joy, and she has very good hearing. And one of my favorite things is that, like, when Manwë and Varda are together, it's this like Wonder Twin powers unite type thing where they have their powers, like, and they can see everywhere and hear everything. And it's just really cool.
I like how Tolkien like sidesteps describing Varda, because he says she's so beautiful, but he's like, there's no words to describe it.
Yeah.
He's just like, she has the light of Iluvatar in her face. Enough said. Moving on.
And if you look at it, you will melt.
And then we have Yavanna, who is the spouse of Aule, giver of fruits, lover of all things that grow in the earth, next to Varda in reverence, and queen of the earth. So we have all these little, like, next to Varda, scarce, less than. So I did have like a some sort of graph, but it never stayed in line, so I just made the little individual bios of them. We also have Nienna, Este, Vaire, Vanna, and Nessa. So those are all the Valar that we just named. And then there are the Aratar, the high ones, Manwë and Varda, Ulmo, Yavanna and Aule, Mandos, Nienna, and Orome. And then he has that special line, Melkor is no longer counted among them.
And his name is not spoken on Earth, and you just did it.
Yeah, I know. but I only said it once. If we say it two more times, then he'll come.
Interesting that he, or I thought it was interesting that he gave him, you know, masculine and feminine sort of gender roles.
He even said that it's not really masculine or feminine. That's just the way it seems to us.
Right. Yeah. That's the way that they wanted to present themselves.
Yeah. And even so, though they don't have kids or anything, so they're not breeding, except for Melian. Her clothes are fertile. Can I just read some things that, like, the describing he does on a lot of these? Because I love some of his wording.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful. So for Melkor, when he took his form, his mood and malice burned within him, making his form dark and terrible, and he descended upon Arda in a power of majesty greater than any of the other Valar, as a mountain that wades into the sea and has its head above the clouds and is clad in ice and crowned with smoke and fire. The light of his eyes was like a flame that withers with heat and pierces with deadly cold. I think that's cool. And then, let's see, I got Almo, when he, like, comes and people see him.
No one else feel bad for Almo, because they're just like, and he goes off and lives alone in the sea, and everyone that's else his is, choice. Like, married.
You feel bad for him, or you're like, way to go, bro.
I know, right? He's the only one that, like, helps out Middle Earth still, after everyone else just shuts him out.
Yeah, he's of the ones, you know, I've got a soft spot for Almo, because he does come into play later on, and he's sort of the thread between, you know, that sort of leaves the door open for the Arendelle to come back eventually. Yeah, he is alone. He dwells nowhere long. So he's restless.
All right, I'm going to try to read this again. Is that okay?
Go ahead.
The arising of the King of the Sea was terrible as a mounting wave that strides to the land with a dark foam-crested helm and raiment of mail shimmering from silver down into the shadows of green. Trumpets of Manway are loud, but Almo's voice is deep as the deeps of the ocean, which only he has seen. And Almo's horns are wrought of white shell, and if you hear them, you will always long for the sea. Thought that was interesting.
Now, I don't want to get too far ahead, but one of the Silmarils went to the bottom of the sea, right?
Yes, one went to the sea, one went to the stars, and one went into a chasm
into the earth.
Yeah.
You would think Olmo might find that one day.
He's just down there going, yes, finally. We have light at the bottom of the sea. And
like, cue Little Mermaid music. Under the sea.
That's what was on the end of the trident.
Yeah, one of my favorite paintings, because like Olmo, they say like he's terrible to behold, but it's one of Ted Nasmyth is in this amazing author, but when you see him, he looks like Ariel's father from The Little Mermaid. He's this giant bearded guy with a trident. It's like you had to give him a trident. But it's still a pretty good painting. I mean,
that was the Olmo and Tour painting, right?
Yeah, where he was before him, because he showed him the armor and everything.
It said that Olmo never took, like, a man form. Like, right here, he's, like, just in a helm, a foam-crested helm and, like, mail. So you probably wouldn't even see him. He's just, like, in the shape of a man.
Yeah. Oh, no, he's got a beard.
Oh, does he?
At least in the painting. Yeah, I always pictured him as, like,
in
this,
painting.
Like... Yeah, I know. This, like, I pictured him as this, like, rippling water, like, that was just in... almost shapeless, but I do like the description of the helm. It's good to have a physical thing to go along with it. But we do get descriptions of the Maiar, who are sort of the Valar's little helpers who came later. And there was one passage which I was kind of confused, because they mention Ilmore was the handmaid of Arda, and they mention Ianwe, who is the banner bearer and herald of Manway, whose might in arms is surpassed by none in Arda. Are we supposed to believe that he's the most powerful of all these guys? He's more powerful than Tulkas and Orome? Or does that mean just of the Maiar?
I think he got a little carried away with the superlatives.
I don't believe it.
He's like, did I already use that one? Shit. Oh, well. Christopher didn't want to change it.
Yeah. That was just one little question I had. But I like him because he's the guy who, you know, proclaims the doom of the Valar and everything. And he's one, like, I can actually picture him. It's weird which characters I can actually picture easily in my head. And for some reason, Ianwe is one of them.
But he dropped the fucking ball with Sauron. Just, like, let him run away.
That's a whole... Yeah, I mean, they're way too forgiving of
Melkor guys.
And, yeah, bad guys in general, and so are the Numenoreans, even though they're kind of tricked.
Well, now you have to come live with us. Oh, okay.
Only for 10,000 years, and then
I could never do any damage there.
Yeah.
Do you guys hate the fact that, like, Tolkien, like, gives you names like, oh, his name is Mandos, but that's not really his name. That's where he lives. His name is Namo. You know what I mean? It's like, just call him Mandos.
Yeah, if you're going to call him Mandos for the whole thing, we don't need to know any of his other names.
I think it was just sort of self-indulgence by Tolkien, or do you think that he thought it was really relevant that, you know, I guess he wanted to make that completed world, there would be, you know, different names for things?
I think it goes more towards the whole purpose of the Silmarillion, where everyone does have six names because they're all in different languages at different, that represent, you know, some are like similar elves, but they're different. So their linguistics are different. And then there's men, and then there's dwarves, and then, you know, hobbits eventually. But I think that's, I don't think it's so much indulgence, but more like reinforcing his whole like reason to write this history, if that makes sense.
No, it definitely does. He's, like we said before, it's a lot of his stuff even started with a name and the stories came later, that it's, if there's a name there, there's a reason for it. And they, you know, he does say that they're known more by their locations than their names. That's the Halls of Mandos and the Gardens of Lorien. But there's, you know, I do like Mandos better than Namo and Irmo. It's a little more epic.
Yeah. Well, I guess he gave him other names to like clarify that the places came before, mm-hmm. and that they took their names from the places and not the other way around.
Yeah, and we have Lorien in The Lord of the Rings, so it's not to be confused with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do I need Namo, Mandos' wife's name, if you're never going to talk about her again? Yeah, she's busy weaving all the history of Middle-earth into her storied webs, but you know what? I don't really need to know that because I'm never going to hear from her again.
Well, we never hear of a lot. I don't think any of the Valar are ever actually named in Lord of the Rings by name. They're, the Valar is mentioned a couple times. I remember when Frodo is with Sean Bean's brother, when he's with Faramir and they make their, like, you know, obeisance to the gods of the West. I think they mention the Valar, and we do have Elbereth, Gilthoniel, and all that. But they're like, we never hear of Nessa or Vanna or any of these guys ever again. And some of them, I tried to, like, when I was making the bios, like, okay, you're this, and then I got to one like Vanna, ever young. Loves flowers and birds. Like, I didn't have anything else to say. And somebody loves dancing, ever dancing. Nessa, lithe and fleet-footed. She loves deer and delights in dancing. Yeah, short straw. Or maybe after he created his ninth god, he was like, all right, let's just get on with the story.
I think his most unique one is Nienna, though. She's so strange. She's just the goddess of grief, which means Melkor's doing a hell of a job if that's a full-time job. She just, like, sits on the edge of existence and looks in and just cries about it.
But that she does not weep for herself, but for those who hearken to her, learn pity and endurance and hope. And I think she's the one that Gandalf hangs out with, right?
Yeah.
So he knows that's Olorin. That's where he gets his drive to help. Yeah, so we do get some of the other Maiar. We have Olorin, who is Gandalf.
Interesting that Olorin is named in the Silmarillion, but Curanir, is that his name?
Yeah, Saruman's. He's not mentioned. I think they mention him later when they talk of the...
at the very, very end.
And the pretty much the most powerful one that does play a big part in the Silmarillion later is Milian, who is, I believe she serves Vanna and Este. But she's, of all of the Valar, she plays maybe the most direct role in interactions with the elves once they get to Middle-earth. And spoiler alert, but she basically marries one of the elven kings and is the mother of Luthien.
Just her clothes.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll get into it on this podcast, but when Melian and what was his name, Thingol Arroway, before, I don't know, when they first meet and they just say that, like, the stars, like, just like, you know, spun around them, mm-hmm. like they just like sat and stared at each other for like years and years.
Everybody was looking like for him.
Yeah,
it's like, come on, dude, get your shit together. You're a king. I thought it was cool that Melkor like corrupted one of Olmo's little Ase. Was that his name?
Ase? Yes.
Yeah.
He like corrupted him and convinced him to like go against Olmo, and that lasted like 3 days. And he was like, "Yeah, I can't win. I give up. I'm sorry. I tried."
Yeah, and you do have the sort of give and take with Ase and Oinen, who, you know, Ase is like always angry and making storms, and then she has to calm him down. And I like the line how they say that Ossé is loved by sailors but not trusted, and I can see that, you know, like making offerings to this god who, you know, can fuck with you, but if you keep him happy, he'll let you get from where you need to go. We can end with the enemies, because Melkor is the main baddie in all of this, and his, you know, underling basically is the main bad guy in Lord of the Rings. So we have Melkor, who is the most powerful. You know, he's basically the guy causing all this trouble, and I can always understand where he's coming from, where he wants the flame imperishable, and he's the creator, and he sort of names Arda as mine. You know, this is my thing, and I'm in charge here, even though we know he's not.
I feel like maybe when he was given like a little bit of everything, he wasn't great at anything. So it kind of like puts him in a weird position where he's jealous because everybody can do something better than him, but he can do things really good, and he's kind of, I don't know, he's like a stepchild.
Well, he was, wasn't he the best at creating things?
Well, no, Aule was
like that other.
Well, they say he was close with Aule. They were both creators, but Aule used his creations within the bounds that he was given, and Melkor didn't.
He was great, but he wasn't as good as Aule. You know, it's like he had all these great things, but he's not as great as another person. So I can see I'd be like second child syndrome for him.
No, that's just like. That's a really good point, because I'm trying to think, even going forward, like anytime he does, he always has to have people like Ungoliant do his dirty work for him, and he didn't create the Silmarils, and that's why he coveted them, is that they, you know, they weren't him, but they were still the most beautiful things.
It must have really galled him that like Feanor created him, like a fucking elf created that shit. I can't do anything right. Yeah. All I did is make this elf look like an orc. Look at that. Crap.
It's almost like Melkor was set up to play his role. Well, I guess he was set up to play his role, but it's almost.
I think that's why Iluvatar was smiling.
Yeah.
They all had their part to play.
And it's funny that Sauron was only less evil than Melkor in that he served another.
Yeah, I did want to get to that, but we'll just mention the other enemies that we're told is the Valar Raukar, the Balrogs. Which, you know, we meet, there's the famous scene of Gandalf battling the Balrog under Moria. And it's, I think it adds more to that scene, knowing that that was almost a godlike creature, not just some, not just a dragon or, you know, it was actually this being that chose to come, and that's how he ended, you know, that Gandalf killed him. I mean, Gandalf was one also, but at the time we don't really know any of that stuff.
I mean, in some ways it was his equal.
Right.
I have got a question. Now, it says that the Treebeard says, or I don't know if he says it or it's said in the Lord of the Rings, that he's the oldest thing on Middle-earth. Does the Balrog not count because it was under Middle-earth?
Well, no, I think he's the oldest living thing that was created, because I believe Yavanna actually created the Ents before like anyone else was created. They call them the Shepherds of the Trees at some point. We're not there yet. It happens, if I'm correct. But I think they are technically the oldest living things in Middle-earth.
The dwarves were created first, but they got put back to sleep.
No, but I think they might have been even after the.
What
I mean,
about
they were
Bombadil?
Trees and stuff.
He's the oldest living thing because all those dwarves are dead.
Well played, sir.
What about Bombadil?
Well, he's one
a Maiar.
He's a Maiar, so we think, you know, he's technically not living. He's just always there.
Gotcha.
So yeah, that line about Sauron, who's also got one of the best badass surnames, Gorthaur the Cruel. Which, I mean, sounds like such a nice guy. I don't know why that'd be a bad name. that's another thing Tolkien does, where the name Gorthaur, if you met someone named Gorthaur, you would distrust them because their name is Gorthaur. he's so good at doing that inherent naming thing that he does. Evil name on the surface of it.
He also turned himself into a wolf.
You had brought up how he says, Sauron was only less evil than his master in that for a long time he served another and not himself. I was completely confused by this line for a while. Is this referencing when he served the Numenoreans, or when the ring was taken from him and he was forced to serve to be at the world?
He served Melkor.
Yeah, that's what I said. Yeah.
Okay.
Melkor.
So I'm going to cut that out, because of course I knew that. I literally spent like 10 minutes like, what is this in reference to? So he's only less evil because he had a boss and he followed orders?
Yeah.
Right, he was second in command.
Second in command, but guys didn't really step to his tune after the big boss left. They're like, yeah, we're just going to go burrow in the earth. We're done.
Yeah, he had some, you know, he had the orcs and you know, at least.
Yeah, but I mean, all the other Maiar, they were like, yeah, we're out of here.
Yeah, because they're smart and they saw what the hell went down the first time this happened. They were like, tap out, I'm done.
You didn't see all the what Tulkas did to Melkor?
Yeah, he cut his fucking feet off, man.
They chained him out in space.
Like all the monsters, like the Balrogs and the spiders, like Shelob's mom or whatever, they didn't defer to him either, right?
No, I don't think so. And he never even had dragons, because they say that the last dragon died before he really came to full power.
Smaug didn't.
Well, I mean, Smaug died before Sauron came back, so he didn't have Smaug. So I think that pretty much wraps it up for the first one. Sorry if this one went a little long, but we did have a, you know, little introduction stuff to get to. But going forward, we're going to try to cover a couple chapters per discussion, keep them under an hour, which will lend itself to a more of a fast-paced way of doing things. I hope you enjoyed this. It wasn't too overwhelming. One of the things I was worried about is people sort of being turned off by the Silmarillion, because it seems to be that the fandom seems to be divided into, you know, like, oh, I can't read the Silmarillion, and I love the Silmarillion. Like, even in the bookstore, if I'll give it to people, they're like, I tried it, I can't do it, there's no hobbits, you know. And I think the hobbits are only on one page, or they might not even be in it at all, like that last page.
I don't think they're even mentioned. Samwise's gardener.
Okay, because he summarizes all of Lord of the Rings in like a paragraph at the end of that last section.
Well, I mean, on the scale, it makes sense, because we're talking about thousands of years here. That was like 1 year.
Right.
Yeah.
And I can see why this wasn't published, you know, right after Lord of the Rings, because I don't think the fandom would have known what the hell it was about. But at the same time, if it was published while Tolkien was alive, there would be no debate as to whether it was who was who, you know, doing what.
I feel like if it was published while he was alive, it'd be far more polished than it is, though.
But I don't know. He didn't finish it because he couldn't finish it. You know, he was this perfectionist, and he would spend hours over talking.
An hour of two sentences.
Yeah, exactly.
Did I use raiment too many times in this paragraph?
Or hearken. I never heard hearken so many times. You hearkened to me, and they hearkened, and then they hearkened.
Are there too many elves in this book?
None yet, though. We don't have any elves yet. So please join us going forward, and we'll see you next time on the Silmarillion cast. Thanks a lot, guys.
Nice.
Thanks.
All right, I think that was a success.
Well, we'll see what we edit, guys. I'm surprised Shellfish doesn't enjoy this. I mean, he likes the...
He'd like Feanor. I think he'd definitely like Feanor.
He likes the appendix, and this is like a giant appendix to me.
Yeah.
So it's strange to me that I can see why people can't get into it and just like read it all the way through, but... That's not really what we're doing, so I feel like you should be able... Anyway.
Well, once you realize it's not about the Lord of the Rings, it's everything before, it's fine.
So Christopher Tolkien has the rights to the Silmarillion, but he hasn't sold them yet.
No, the whole reason that... is basically Tolkien himself sold the rights to The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings back in the 60s to whatever company later became New Line Cinema, I think.
Yeah.
And
it's 20th Century Fox now, I think.
Right, but the fact that The Silmarillion wasn't written yet was not part of that package. And in the years since, Christopher Tolkien did not like what Peter Jackson did. And Peter Jackson can't even reference anything that's not in The Lord of the Rings or the appendices. And that's, you know... There's that line about Sam when Sam's talking about the old, you know, cities of Gondolin and Nargothrond in the book that he didn't mention that in the movie when he could have, but that was one thing that they could have gotten some like ancient, you know, Silmarillion stuff out there, but he chose not to.
Hey guys. Yeah. I was going to just be on the call for a bit, and now it's an hour and 40 minutes later. I really enjoyed this, but I got to go.
Right. Thanks for joining us. I'll let you know when it's going to be going out.
All right. Great chatting, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Night.
Bye.
I always thought the Silmarillion kind of would lend itself to some sort of animated feature, but, you know, it's kind of... thought of as lesser art, I think, mm-hmm. around here, that they wouldn't do it that way. But I mean, it's so abstract, and, you know, it'd be so difficult to actually, even with what we can do with CGI now, it'd still be difficult to adapt to Silmarillion.
Also, it's one of those things that, like, if you saw it on the screen, it might take away from the epic and mystery that surrounds it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like... hearing about these things as tales is more power than seeing them on the screen. And then if it's not done well, it can take away from it almost. It's tough to separate it once you've seen it, you know?
Yeah, I definitely think it might be a better way to go would be like a movie about one story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like a Children of Húrin movie. I actually think it'd make a better miniseries than a movie because...
Well, that's one of the few...
That'd be a downer.
Yeah. That's one of the few, like, really complete self-contained stories that's from it. And that would definitely, you know, that's got whole, like, Oedipus connections and there's a lot going on there. And it's
they
pretty
could do
depressing.
It on HBO.
They'd probably have to change the ending because, you know, how Hollywood executives are, oh, we can't do that. People won't like it. We have to change it.
It's got a talking sword and a talking dragon. How do they not do it?
I say just see like what other people can do too, because I mean, you don't want the same group for every single one.
No, that's.
I mean,
ideally,
everybody
like
was here was fine. I'm not saying, man, that Varley. Sheesh.
Now that Matt's gone, jeez. Yeah, but I know I'd love to get Beric on these since I've heard him see him post about everything and he's obviously passionate about them, but I haven't actually
be passionate about a lot.
Has he podcasted before?
I don't think so, no. But he said he'd get involved eventually. But yeah, hopefully, even if it's a newcomer and you haven't podcasted, this was Matt's first time. Who am I talking to? We're done anyway. We'd be happy to have you. So there we go.
All right, so a Valar, an Eldar, and a Maiar walk into a bar. Stop me if you heard this before.
So, Matt, this is your first official VOK podcast?
Like first podcast official ever. So be gentle.
All right.
Well, if it's your first podcast, then you have to fight.
Yeah. I think Shane's the elder statesman when it comes to VOK among us here, right?
Oh, Lord.
So yeah, I didn't mean to intimidate everyone with the notes. I started like doing brief bullet points, but then I ended up with 6 Tolkien books on my desk and just random notes and everything. So I think it's pretty makes sense, but I don't know. It kind of felt like I was back in school again doing a paper, and I really liked it. So I think I'm gonna go back to college after finishing this series. But the whole parts with like the gods and everything—that's really just like in case you confuse them. Like we're not gonna go through and name them all. Maybe we can like pick your favorite or. There's some that I think are pretty lame, and I don't really know what they do, so maybe we can talk about them. But
I've like written down some like quotes that I really like the descriptions of them, but other than that, I don't really care what we do.
Okay, yeah, but like I said, I don't want to make it like I think an hour is pretty reasonable.
Okay,
and I listened to the book club one, and I know I talk really fast sometimes, so I have a sign in front of me that says slow down, but if I'm talking too fast, just like cough or something, and then I'll realize that. I don't really pick up on it until, you know, it's all done with. And I have to rely on Brett to keep it silly, so Bina and Nadia are happy because they were worried about us not being silly enough.
Oh, at the beginning, you should be like, you know what, like that, I don't remember which one it was, but one of them that Nadia was like, Bina, do you know what they're talking about? At the beginning of this, we could be like, if you asked yourself this question, then this series is for you.
Pretty sure that song, the Ride Captain Ride by Blues, whatever, from the 7th was about Yarendil, the Ride Captain Ride upon your mystery ship, all that. They were channeling Tolkien there.
Well, was it Zeppelin's Ramble On and Misty Mountain Hop?
Oh, yeah. Right. I mean, Zeppelin and Rush, they were definitely heavy into Tolkien.
Have y'all heard Leonard Nimoy's hit? I don't know if it was a hit.
Bilbo
the song about Bilbo.
Oh, yeah. He sang that in the animated movie, right?
I thought it was something he just did on YouTube. Yeah, he just did on like some TV show, but it was I've definitely seen that. And he had the elf ears. He didn't even need to. He just went right from Star Trek to the elf ears. But I was going to bring up elf ears at some point, too, because at no point in the Silmarillion or any Tolkien book does it mention that elves have pointy ears. It came from like a throwaway line, and I think it was in one of the Book of Lost Tales or the Histories of Middle-earth that they referenced pointy ears, but that could even have been like a misinterpretation of what he meant. So it's just to tell humans and elves apart, because if they're identical except for one lives forever, it's kind of tough to tell.
And has
longer
hair.
I was flipping through Unfinished Tales earlier, because I left my copy of Silmarillion at work today. Oops.
Of all days.
Yeah. It was talking about how when the Ishtar, the wizards, came to Middle-earth, many mistook them for men and many mistook them for elves. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, they were mistaken for both.
They even talked about Gandalf, that he walked with elves and they didn't even know that he was not one of them. It was written somewhere in there.
Yeah, so if they had if they had pointy ears, that would have been mentioned at one point. But it's not about the pointy ears.
I like pointy ears, so I don't care. and you can feel free to cut this out because it's the stupidest thing ever, but it's just the way I feel. I happen to be like reading, not this time, but like one of the first times I read it, the Jurassic Park theme song was on, and from now on, like, I always hear it in my head as the Jurassic Park theme song. And Melkor is just like that really loud trumpet that keeps repeating and repeating. And that's just how I see it. I don't know why.
Yeah, I was third trumpet in high school, and that was the only song that I could play without sheet music was the Jurassic Park theme song.
So, like, there's this trumpet that's just louder than all the rest, and it sounds great in the song, but you can tell it's, like, trying to be better. And they even have, like, the parts where it's, like, the strings and stuff, and that I feel like is, like, Nienna's part. But, you know, it's just stupid shit in my head. So you can cut that out if you want. I don't care.
Oh,
so Melkor is the T-Rex roaring in the end of it?
Well, so the Alex, theme song. Oh. He doesn't really roar, but maybe on the movie he does.
Alex, you're a good musician, right? I've seen some YouTube videos.
Get to
Do
it.
Do you have any music that comes to mind?
Well, actually, I looked it up last night. I tried to find like pieces inspired by Silmarillion and especially the music of the Ainur, because the description is so clear that you could really like write a piece of music that corresponds to like the first theme and then the second theme and then Melkor. But I didn't find anything.
Yeah,
I've looked. Like, no composer has attempted this.
I've looked to try to get Jurassic Park out of my head.
Look up A Night in Rivendell, I believe the music series called. Yeah, that was a big dork bomb I just dropped, too. But yeah, it's all music inspired by Lord of the Rings and Silmarillion.
Oh, nice. I'll definitely check that out. Maybe if someone actually gets the music right, it'll inadvertently create this world, and then we can all go there and hang out.
Oh my god, that would be awesome. No, I think there's also an album by Blind Guardian that is inspired by the Silmarillion, but it's more like the whole story, not just the creation.
Okay, let's do this. I didn't type anything out as an official introduction, but I think I can wing it.
You don't read them that well anyway.
Yeah, I know. Thank you.